You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. I'd like now to introduce Josh Horwitz. He's executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence in Washington, D.C. He's co-author of the book Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea, and he's co-founder of the Consortium for Risk-Based Firearm Policy, which is a group of mental health and public health experts who examine the intersection of guns and mental health. Welcome, Josh Horwitz.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate your being here. The day after the massacre in Parkland, Florida, I was wheeling a shopping cart in a big box store here in Santa Fe, and an old man came up to me and said very respectfully, "May I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." He said, "What do you think of the idea of having armed guards in every school?" And I said to him, "Well, personally, I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, first of all, from the shooter's perspective, it's too easy to go to a different part of the school where the guard isn't. And anyway, if somebody wanted the guard's gun, he could hit him over the head with it and take his gun. And how well trained are those guys anyway? And it would be very expensive compared to the cost of prevention." I said all this, and he looked at me and he said very politely, "Thank you for sharing your opinion, but I don't want to see any more children killed by guns. So really, don't you think we should have armed guards in every school?" And I kind of looked at him and didn't know what else to say. And I just thought, this is like a little microcosm of how the conversation about guns is going in the United States right now. Talk about your experience of the media conversation about gun violence and gun safety. You've been at this a long time. What is talked about? What's left out of the mainstream presentations? How has this shifted over the years?
Well, I think your anecdote is really spot on. I've had numerous experiences where I'm talking to somebody who has a heartfelt belief in gun rights, and I'm talking about a topic, maybe it's background checks, and they'll come back to me and said, "You know, I'm really sorry you're talking about banning guns. If you only had talked about background checks, I would have been appreciative." And I looked at the guy and said, "That's what I was talking about." And I think that we talk past each other. We don't hear each other very well in this debate. And I think that's really a problem. I think in the discussion that we're seeing around Parkland, it's, I think, one of the first times that I've seen people really want to sort of drop their guard and say, we've got to get to the bottom of this. And the sort of discussion in Washington has been somewhat remarkable. Now, it's already starting to harden a little bit and people are getting in their corners, but there is a core group of people who seem to be saying, we need to overcome our differences. We need to listen. We can't talk past each other, and let's try to get something done.
Part of the deeper problem about the conversation about guns is that there are fundamentally different views about freedom and democracy, and these are big words that underlie different sides of this conversation. For many people, the idea of freedom includes safety, freedom from violence, but even that divides between those who think safety is better served by having more guns and those who think it's about having fewer guns. What is the actual empirical evidence about that?
Well, the empirical evidence about firearms is that easy access to firearms leads to more gun deaths. That's very clear. You see access to firearms being a big issue in suicide. Access to firearms are a big issue in making crime lethal. Guns, you know, don't necessarily cause crime, but they make whatever criminality tend to be more lethal, more violent. Recently, we've heard a lot in the United States about concealed carry laws. And for a while, there was a discussion that concealed carry laws, liberal access to concealed carry weapons would make us safer. There's new data that shows that that's just not true, that states that have easy access to concealed carry weapons actually have had a 12 to 15% increase in violent crime and homicide in the last 10 years. So the data is pretty clear, both on the sort of criminal violence homicide side and the suicide part of gun violence equation, that access to firearms leaves us more susceptible to death and injury.
Gun owners, who are not the majority, but they make up a large minority of citizens here in the U.S., are not one monolithic group. They comprise sportsmen and hunters. There are people who want to keep them at home for self-defense. And then there's a group of people whom you've written extensively about called insurrectionists. Who are they? What are their ideas about guns and their agendas?
Well, right. So it is a mistake to think of gun owners as a monolith. And look, there are many gun owners who own one firearm. They use it. They keep it in their home. They bought that for self-defense. There are others who, you know, of course, are hunters. But then there's a group that you mentioned that believe that firearms ownership is the key to keeping them free. And the reason they think that is because they believe that at any moment a tyrannical government could impose their view on them and their will on them. And so that the insurrectionists, it's a what I call an insurrectionist reading of the Second Amendment, which is that the Second Amendment gives them the right to take up arms against the government if the government becomes tyrannical. Now, my critique of that is that who gets to decide when the government becomes tyrannical? One man's universal health care can be another's tyranny. And so my feeling is that there is, and I think our history is makes this extremely clear, that there is, in fact, no right to take up arms against the government and no individual right to take up arms against the government. If that were true, we would be in a suicide pact where each individual would be able to decide when tyranny is occurring and open fire on the government. That all sounds maybe something that's more conceptual, but then you have to think about people like Gabby Giffords, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who are actually shot. So it's not theoretical. And the other point about this is the insurrectionists in many ways are driving the push for more and more assault weapons. They want the same type of weaponry as the military because they feel that they may have to take on the military. And this gets back to your discussion of freedom. What really is freedom? You have to think clearly. So individual freedom to do whatever you want is not freedom for your neighbors. So your freedom to extend your right arm ends at my nose. And who is to protect the interplay between rights between people if the government is not able to do that? Think about the idea that courts provided by government are in fact the greatest protector of individual rights, but they are provided by the government to do that. Without government power, whoever has the most individual power might make right. And I think we need to be very careful to understand that unlimited individual freedom actually incurs and reduces freedom for other people. So I think that's a sort of a way we need to look at this. But the insurrectionist idea is that we have guns to take on the government. And I believe that is actually a very anti-democratic, anti-freedom type of activity.
I mean, it's so interesting to me because it goes all the way back to our founding. And these questions were hotly debated at the time of our founding. And they're rooted, at least in part, in the split between people like Thomas Jefferson, who thought we should be wary of our own government at all times, and Alexander Hamilton, who was really more worried about the rabble than the government. You know, who do you trust? Do you trust the mob? Do you trust the government? And these are questions that have been part of our national debate since before we were a nation. How do you see, I mean, is that playing out in this whole question about these insurrectionists and the Second Amendment?
Well, it is. But what we've got to realize is the change in America between the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution was quite palpable. By the time that 1787 arose and the Constitution was drafted, there were mobs in all of our major cities. The Articles of Confederation were not powerful enough. And when Shay's Rebellion broke out, people came to Philadelphia. The leaders of our country at that point, George Washington and others, came because they were afraid of disunion. And they wrote the Constitution as a way to increase power in the federal government to keep this country together. And the idea, and of course, Washington would be aghast at the idea that there's an individual right to take on the government. They wrote that Constitution specifically to increase power in government. And the debate about the militia, you know, at that time was not about, you cannot find almost no discussion of an individual right to have guns. The discussion was who gets to control the militia. That was the discussion of the day. So now it's been completely changed over time and taking an anti-federalist view as a romanticized view. And people want to say, well, that's what was going on. That's not what was going on. The federalist view of a strong constitution was the view. And even Jefferson, who you mentioned as sort of the famous quote about the blood of the patriots. If you read the historical record, Madison castigated him for that discussion. And ultimately, when it was his turn to become president, he had no problem using federal authority to put down rebellion or to try Aaron Burr and to any of those things. So our history, you have to read it carefully. The idea that there was an individual right to fight government tyranny did not exist in the Constitution. It would have been anathema to our founders, and it should be an anathema today. But yet it is used to sell assault weapons. We see it all the time now coming from the NRA and the gun lobby. Say, hey, stock up on your weapons. The government will be coming for you, and they're going to become tyrannical. They may want to sell more guns, but the use of that history is incorrect.
The militias of that time bore no resemblance to what people are calling militias today. It was the equivalent of what, the National Guard or the state police or something like that?
Right. So the militia at that point, now we have unregulated militias. People just run around the woods and call themselves the militia. That's nothing like what we had in the 1780s, in the 1770s. What we had then was, you know, you had to report, you had to register your weapon, you had to report for muster. It was considered a political right to be part of that militia. And there was strict rules about who could participate, the types of weapons you had. There was surveys of the weapons that were there. And it was an attempt to, you know, a well-regulated militia. That's what the amendment's talking about. Now, ultimately, the militia system failed. And that's how we ended up with the regular army. And George Washington himself thought the militia system was not well organized and was not effective. But then you were under the authority of your local government. That's not true for a bunch of guys running around the woods in camo with an assault rifle, you know, being weekend warriors. That's just a mob.
One of the issues underlying all of this seems to be race relations in the United States. I mean, we're not seeing these insurrectionists urging African-American citizens of, let's say, Ferguson or Baltimore, cities like that, to arm themselves against an unjust government. And if anybody could be called an unjust part of the government, it's the police who are killing African-Americans at a higher rate than they're killing white citizens. Talk about your perception of the role of race in the United States culture of guns.
Well, obviously, I think there's a strong component here. And I think the gun lobby tries to sell guns. Their number one basis is selling guns is fear. And whenever Wayne LaPierre gives a speech like he gave it at CPAC recently, fear is the number one idea. And they use terms like thugs and muggers and things like that, terms that are coded to make people scared, to invoke racial animus. And, you know, you have people like Ted Nugent on the NRA board talking incredibly derogatory terms about the Obamas. Race or coded racial language is used to produce fear, and fear produces sales. It's an awful thing, and it certainly, I think, has harmed this country. Now, I think it's also important to understand, though, that there is a movement. There's something called the African American Gun Clubs around the country, comprised of people in the African American community who are gun enthusiasts. I think it's important to understand that there are people represented in all sides of this issue. And so it's wrong just to say that gun ownership is only a white phenomena. But I think race is something that the NRA and other groups use to drive gun sales. And we've seen more than veiled racism coming out of that organization for a long time.
Talk to us about the role of the NRA in setting the terms of the debate and in wielding power in Washington. What does that actually look like?
Well, I think that the NRA is in many ways overblown. I think they are much more feared right now in Republican primaries than they are in general elections. But for people who run in Republican primaries, they're quite scared of the NRA. I personally don't know that they have to be. I think that the NRA has proven that in general elections, they have very little influence. There is a perception among Republicans that the NRA is powerful. I think the Democrats have largely shrugged that off and don't care anymore. And if you look at the results in the general election in Virginia, for instance, you will see that the Democrats, our new governor, Ralph Northam, really pushed the NRA and said, I am not afraid of you at all in your home state. The whole Democratic ticket even protested outside the NRA headquarters and then went to win in the statewide election by 9 points. So there is a perception that the NRA is powerful in Washington. the reality is that they are more powerful in the Republican base, which drives Republicans in the Senate and the House to take positions that are out of step with the vast majority of Americans. Remember, things like background checks polls in the high 90s among both gun owners and non-gun owners alike. So again, I think the NRA's power is way overblown, but they do have sway over a segment of the Republican base, which is, I think, more problematic now for Republicans.
So if there is such a big gap between what the public wants and what our legislators do, and if the NRA's mythological, sort of mythical power isn't as great as maybe we think it is, then why do our legislators not bring the public what they want? First of all, tell us, based on your research, what the public does want, and then why we're not getting it.
Well, look, I think there's great agreement that we have to have background checks. All people across all demographics want background checks. We've heard a lot about these extreme risk protection orders in the last couple of weeks, something I've worked closely on, hugely popular. And actually, in the states, we're seeing great progress with some of these policies. But people don't realize a couple things. Congress in the Senate is not a majority-ruled institution. It's based on 60 votes. And so, you know, after Sandy Hook, there were 55 votes in the Senate for background checks, but the bill didn't pass. That's because of the filibuster requirement. And because of gerrymandering, even though far more people in this country vote for Democratic members of the House, because of gerrymandering, we have a slim Republican majority. And again, they're afraid of their primaries because of their districts are gerrymandered to be largely plus Republican districts. And again, if you can control the Senate with 40 votes and the House is gerrymandered, it's very difficult for Congress to move forward. Now, I want people not to get discouraged and think that the U.S. Congress is the only metric that matters. I worked in Washington, worked here for almost 30 years. Congress has a very hard time getting anything done because of the reasons I say. It's not particularly responsive to the will of the people, which is a huge problem, but that's just the reality. There's a huge consensus around immigration reform. We can't get that done either. So Congress, in many ways, is broken, and it's not broken because of guns. It's broken because of all sorts of other things like gerrymandering and filibustering and all sorts of things like that. But I think we're starting to see a lot of progress in the states, and I think that's where we're really excited about some of the policy pieces that we're looking for. And you're starting to see states expand their background check systems, expand their domestic violence prohibitions, begin to develop these extreme risk protection orders. And you can see the pace of that accelerating in the last couple of weeks. There's a lot of bills introduced where people thought they might not move. And after the Parkland shooting, there is really a real emphasis to get some things done in the states this year. And you're starting to see that happen. And what we hope is that when some of these states move forward, these states move forward, eventually Congress gets the idea and gets something done.
What do you think are the actually most effective on-the-ground means to reduce gun violence? Like, what are some of those things that are happening in the states, and how are they being used, and to what effect?
Sure. So, and look, most of these things, you have to start with a strong background check system. You have to have a background check system that extends to all firearm transactions. I mean, there can be a couple of exceptions between family members, but you can't have a background check system that's effective when you can go to a gun show or go online and buy a gun without a background check. So you need a background check that's comprehensive, but that's not enough in and of itself. You need to make sure that there's a couple of things that we think will really save lives. Let's make sure that you have a comprehensive background check. Let's make sure that we have the right prohibitors in there. For instance, right now, you're prohibited from possessing a gun if you have a felony conviction, if you've been committed to a mental institution. And there are many other types of prohibitions that would be very effective and targeted to people at risk of violence that we don't have. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Although permanent domestic violence protective orders are gun prohibitory, temporary orders in many states, and I believe New Mexico is one of those, are not. So as soon as you get that protective order the first time, which is the time of heightened risk of violence, that protective order does not come with a gun prohibition until about 14 days later when a permanent order is issued. That makes very little sense. And then crimes of domestic violence at any level, misdemeanor or not, should be gun prohibitory. People who commit acts of violence are much more likely to commit future acts of violence than the general population. Another good risk-based policy would be to make all violent misdemeanor crimes a prohibition, at least for a short amount of time. And then the last thing we really like, we think has been very effective, and there's some great data developing on this, is this extreme risk protection order, where family members or law enforcement can ask a court to give them an order to remove the firearm while somebody is in a crisis. And that crisis could be brought on by mental illness, but doesn't have to be. Let's remember that most people with mental illness are never going to be violent. But for whatever reason, maybe it's alcohol abuse, if people are in a state where they're acting violently, threatening violence, being cruel to animals, whatever it is, let's get the guns out of their hands while they seek the help they need. And these are extreme risk protection orders are temporary. They last anywhere from 14 days to a year, but they give clear legal authority to law enforcement to get firearms out of the situation before something catastrophic happens. And often the data is that they're actually an excellent tool to prevent suicides. Finally, I would say, well, if I give you two more examples of policies that I think were important. And remember, these are complex webs, right? No one policy will stop everything. It's a complex web that we need to develop of interlaced policies. But there's some very good data now that on top of the background check, something called a permit to purchase, where you have to be in contact with law enforcement and get a permit in addition to the background check, is a very effective tool. And there's some very strong data on that. And the other thing that we'd like to see is people invest in community-based and evidence-based violence prevention programs. Things like, they're formally named as Focused Deterrence, but people may know them as projects like Ceasefire or Cure Violence. These are important community-based projects that work in partnership with law enforcement in the community that save lives as well. So I know I've named a bunch of different proposals, but let's remember, violence and gun violence especially takes many different forms. There's no one cure for all gun violence. And, you know, I can't stand when people say, you know, I'm talking about one proposal and someone says, well, that wouldn't save all lives. And you're right, nothing, no one proposal will save all lives. But an effective, evidence-based, interlaced group of proposals can save a lot of lives. And that's what I'm proposing.
When you talk about a permit to have a gun, would that be sort of like having a license to drive a car, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's, think about a permit as permission to act. Absolutely. You want to make sure that someone has been in contact with law enforcement, that they've had a thorough background check, maybe have to be proficient in some of the, some knowledge. So I think there's a number of ways to do that. But the idea of interaction with law enforcement prior to purchasing a firearm seems to be a very effective way to reduce gun violence.
That would also, I have to say, require a rebuilding of trust between citizens and law enforcement, which is really, for many of us, not just the Black community and minority communities, really compromised for so many people.
Well, you've hit on an incredibly important issue. Trust is an important issue between law enforcement and the community, and it shouldn't be surprising, where there is trust building and trust, you tend to see less acts of violence. And so we need to see procedurally just policing, especially in the gun interdiction area. We need to make sure that when law enforcement are either pulling people over or looking for firearms, that they do that in a procedurally just way, so that it can't be discriminatory, and it has to be based on objective criteria and done in a thoughtful manner. And I think you're right. I mean, trust is such an important piece, which is one of the reasons I really like the Ceasefire projects and the Cure Violence. That's really the purpose of these things, is to work with law enforcement in a trusting, collaborative way rather than an us versus them way.
There are people talking about preventive ideas like putting metal detectors in schools the way they have them in courthouses and so on. What's your perspective on that?
Well, look, I think my perspective on this and whether we need armed security guards and things like that really gets down to the local level and the local needs of the school system. And I think it's important to understand that you can make your schools a more protective environment at the same time that you're making sure that people who would be a threat to your school don't have easy access to firearms. I hope that we don't get into this position of whether it's arming teachers, which I think is a terrible idea, or doing some kind of meaningful gun violence prevention. You know, I hope we don't get into that debate. I think we can do gun violence prevention. I think we can leave the school security plans down to the individual school district in consultation with their local law enforcement. But I do think, just as a note, that the idea of arming teachers is a terrible idea. Recently, a teacher discharged a firearm within their classroom. Teachers should be armed with knowledge and books and scientific equipment. And the idea that they're going to become law enforcement is a terrible idea. There's a way to deal with it that's, I think, smart and appropriate. And if we want to have a discussion about having trained security, that's one thing. But let's remember, these are complex areas that need thoughtful local solutions.
Let's talk for a moment about mental illness. You changed your mind about guns and mental illness after Sandy Hook, and you wrote about that. What happened? Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me prior to Sandy Hook, before I gave a lot of thought to this, I would have said, oh, yeah, you know, people with mental illness shouldn't have firearms. They can't handle it. They're all dangerous. And it turns out that I was wrong. After Sandy Hook, I convened a group of mental health experts, academics, and practitioners, along with public health experts. And I'm an adjunct professor at the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. And so I was able to leverage some of my colleagues to participate. And after examining the evidence closely, I was sort of startled to realize that most people with mental illness will never be dangerous. People with mental illness are more likely to be a victim of a crime than to commit a crime. And here's the kicker for me, is that if you just think in terms of interpersonal violence, if you look at mental illness alone, it's responsible for about 4% of the total interpersonal violence each year. So you could cure mental illness, and which we should. We should do all we can to alleviate the suffering that mental illness can cause. But that wouldn't stop our interpersonal violence epidemic. And so what I realize is if we're going to focus on people who are at risk of violence and making sure while they're at increased risk of violence, they don't have access to a firearm, spending all your resources on the mental illness front is misguided. We should be looking at risky behavior where there's a much stronger connection to violence. What's the biggest risk to violence? Past violence. Past violence is one of the biggest risk factors for future violence. Another big risk factor, alcohol abuse. So when you combine some of these factors together, you know, you can really understand where risk can be much greater. Mental illness alone is just not one of those risk factors. And so focus on mental illness alone, we find to be quite misguided.
You, a few moments ago, gave a sort of a list of things that no one policy or no one law will take care of the problem of gun violence, but taken together could really make a big difference. And we can look to other countries that have a very low rate of gun violence and see what they're doing, and some of the stuff that you've said. What of the things that you've mentioned do you think could have prevented the Parkland massacre?
Oh, well, look, I think the extreme risk protection order is number one on the list. Law enforcement had many contacts with this person, yet did not have the clear legal authority to remove that firearm. And so I think the extreme risk protection order is number one on that list. I will also say that I did not mention assault weapons before, but assault weapons are weapons of war, and while they may not, again, cause crime, they certainly contribute to the lethality when they're used, especially when equipped with a high-capacity magazine. So I think in that circumstance, if you had an extreme risk protection order, the shooting may not have occurred, but also adding the element of an assault weapon with high-capacity magazine to that made sure that that particular attack would be especially lethal.
There are some bizarre things. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but is it true that under federal law, you have to be 21 years of age to buy a handgun, but in many states, you can buy a rifle if you're just 18, like including the AR-15?
That's correct. That's federal law, and I'm sure that's the law in New Mexico. It's certainly the law where I live in Virginia, and it's the law in Florida. So the federal law is 21 for a handgun, 18 for a long gun, and it's really antiquated. So that has been the law since at least 1968, maybe before, but it was codified in the 1968, what they call the Gun Control Act. And that's when handguns were used mostly in crime. There was no such thing as assault weapons. The idea of having assault weapons in the civilian market didn't creep in until the late 1980s. So that distinction is a relic of a different age when handguns were the guns that were the real problem. Now, handguns are still a big problem. That's not the issue. It's just that we see an uptick, especially in these mass shootings of assault weapons. And those just weren't around when this law, the 18 and 21-year-old distinction, were made. And so the idea was, well, look, people can go out hunting, but to own a handgun, which at the time was thought to be more involved in criminality, let's raise the age to 21. Now, both should be 21. And there's really good evidence that violence is a young and male activity. You see your peak levels of violence in men between, I think it's 19 and 20, or maybe 18 and 19. So preventing people from having guns at that age could actually make a big difference.
Here in New Mexico, in the recent legislative session that just finished, we passed a bill with respect to gun violence prevention. Tell us about that bill, the support for it, and why it did not become law.
Well, so that bill, which was focused on domestic violence, was exactly what I was discussing, which was to extend the prohibition beyond the federal law. So we're at right now, New Mexico doesn't really have good state law in the domestic violence and gun space. And what this would have done was created an ability to, once you create New Mexico's own prohibition, then you can really begin to enforce the laws. And we all talk about enforcing the laws, but unless there's a state prohibition that extends, like I mentioned, hopefully to even temporary domestic violence protection orders, then you can have a much more robust enforcement scheme. So that law passed the House, passed the Senate with a lot of work from New Mexicans to prevent gun violence. And unfortunately, the governor vetoed it, and which was really sad. This would have been a law which would really protect New Mexicans, and it would have added a state law around domestic violence and the ability for state law enforcement to remove firearms and save lives.
It's a little hard to understand on a basic level because our governor is a former prosecutor.
You know, it was really shocking. I mean, it was shocking. It passed both the House and the Senate. It would have given law enforcement new tools to protect those who are a threat of violence because of domestic issues. And I was shocked. I thought she was going to sign it, especially since it passed with the bipartisan approach. And I was just shocked. And I think it's a real shame because New Mexico is a state that is especially afflicted by gun violence. Domestic violence is something that has deeply affected the state, and to create new tools for law enforcement to protect the victims of gun violence, protect women, I think would have been something that would have been really helpful and saved lives. And I just, for the life of me, am shocked that she vetoed it.
Give us an example of a state that has passed gun laws along the lines that you're talking about and what the results have been of those new laws?
Sure. I mean, Connecticut's a very good example. Connecticut enacted a permit to purchase law a number of years ago. Missouri, for instance, got rid of their permit to purchase law, and homicide went up in Missouri where they got rid of the law and down in Connecticut where they have the law. So that's a good example in permit to purchase. If you think about states like New York and Massachusetts and Hawaii and even California, where you've seen the steady development of a solid gun violence prevention system, and you can see that the rates of gun violence have decreased, both on homicide and especially in suicide. So you can see some of these states that have permit to purchase, they have universal background checks, they have limited certain types of weapons. These states are now developing these risk protection orders, and these states have lower death rates. I mean, your listeners might be shocked to hear this, but when you think about what are the states that are on the number one and two or three in gun death, and that's Alaska and Louisiana often trade back and forth. Louisiana, because it has a suicide problem, but a very, very high gun homicide problem. And Alaska, because it has a very high gun suicide and very high homicide rates. And one of the defining factors of those states and all the states that have high gun violence rates are that they have very, very loose laws.
You have outlined some laws and policies that make a lot of sense. Do you think that we're getting to a point where laws like that would satisfy both gun owners and non-gun owners, that we can find consensus?
Well, you know, we're talking about this now. You know, in a couple of weeks, I may change my mind, but I've seen remarkable consensus developing since this terrible shooting. And, you know, President Trump from the White House was talking about the need for, he uses the word strong background checks. And he seems to be supporting the Manchin-Toomey bill, which is a bill that was first proposed after Sandy Hook, but as I mentioned, didn't get out of the Senate. You're seeing a lot of consensus across the aisle on these ERPO bills, extreme risk protection order bills. So I think you're seeing a little more division on, for instance, the assault weapons bill. That doesn't mean things are going to pass Congress because of the barriers I mentioned, but I am seeing a real coalescence around a couple of core ideas. If Congress can't get it done, it's a political failure inbred into the infighting in that institution right now. But I'm very confident that the American people are coming around to the idea that we need to make sure that we have tools to get guns out of the hands of those most at risk for violence, that we want to make sure that weapons are not in the hands of people at risk. And to do that, that we need to make sure that we're adequately checking backgrounds. And so we can have the best risk-based prohibitions developed, but if people can go around the background check system, that doesn't help. So I believe that we're starting to see, I mean, if you look at the polling numbers and you look at even some of the political rhetoric, you're starting to see a coalescence around a couple of core ideas that I think are quite important and will save lives.
You've been working in this field of gun violence, attempt to prevent violence, for a long time. You're also a father. What is this like for you emotionally, year after year, now decades pass, and there hasn't been the kind of change that many of us have hoped for?
Well, I start by the fact that if this was easy, anybody could do it. I don't kid myself that this is a walk in the park. This is very, very hard generational type of change. I take heart in the fact that the states have changed a lot of laws for the better in the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm generally believed as an activist that cynicism is the enemy of activism. So I try to be optimistic and not a cynic. I will say, and this is a personal note, that the night of the Parkland shooting, I'd actually left work early that day. It was Valentine's Day, and I wanted to make a nice evening and meal for my daughter and for my wife. And as the news started to trickle in, as I was trying to prepare something and take care of my own family, it became incredibly apparent that there are families who would never hug their loved ones again, never be able to make a beautiful meal for them, and that they were suffering tremendous loss. And the juxtaposition between what I had thought that evening was going to be like and what the evening turned out to be for families across Florida was absolutely heartbreaking. And it was one of the lowest moments in my career. But you know what? You have to wake up and get back to work. You have to go fight. You have to get the cynicism away and say, I'm going to honor these lives with action. And the next morning, that's what I did. In fact, I got up and did a TV show at 8 o'clock the next morning and just have kept rolling since then. And I'm determined not to let these lives go without making major change in this country.
Josh Horwitz is Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My absolute pleasure.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by DotFoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.